It's another Friday, and that means it's our podcast, the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where every week I, John Zogby, and my son and partner, Jeremy Zogby, look at some of the key news of the week and talk about it a bit in a very calm sort of manner. No rhetoric here. Jer, how you doing this week?
I'm doing very well, and I'm looking forward to the weekend, Mother's Day weekend, so happy Mother's Day to all of our listeners that are mothers or will be mothers fairly soon.
So what do we got this week?
We've got a lot, and the first topic that I think we should get out of the way that's probably on the front of people's minds is where do we stand? Where does the country stand with the presidential race? And where does Joe Biden stand? What are the prospects for his VP choice? Is it the same as last week as we discussed, or are there some new things, new factors to consider? And then obviously the story of Tara Reid, which is not going to go away. Where do we stand on that? So why don't you kick us off with that?
There's a lot going on without a lot going on. You know, there are no campaign rallies, no TV coverage to speak of. Biden in his basement and Trump in his White House, although he did fly out, made a controversial trip to Arizona without a mask. But where do we stand? You know, nationwide, Joe Biden leads the president. But the lead has gone down on average from about 6 or 7 points down to 3 to 5 points. A couple of polls having it nearly tied and a couple of polls having it at 9 or 10, Biden's lead. Same sort of trend in the key battleground states. Biden leading, but not by much. Some states doing better than others. Michigan, for example, but Wisconsin is very close and Florida is very close. Problematic, I would say, particularly for Biden at this moment, are the numbers of undecideds, higher than normal for, say, a late April or early May. And the reason that doesn't bode well is that presidents, incumbents, are always well known. And so, granted, people have made up their minds about the incumbent. So undecided means they just haven't made up their minds about the challenger and still need to be shown more. And it's from this group that we look, you know, in the latter stages of the campaign to either tip towards the challenger or to wonder whether or not they're going to vote. If they don't tip to the challenger and we don't start to see that, then we're going to look at another one of those presidential elections, you know, that are too close to call. And so at the moment, Biden leading, but there's a lot going on. Now, you mentioned vice presidential nominees, and we've talked about this before, but, you know, sort of briefly in bullet form. Always a lot of drama about VP picks, but ultimately the races, presidential races, are about the presidential candidates themselves. There have been some instances where a vice presidential nominee matters in the long haul, the most obvious one being Jack Kennedy nominating a man that he truly hated and who hated him. Lyndon Johnson, but Johnson delivered Texas, and that allowed Kennedy to win. So last couple of times, I've been talking mainly about my thinking that it makes lots of sense for Joe Biden to pick someone who is a fellow moderate and who can deliver a real state. And so I've been high on, first and foremost, Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan. She's still high on my list. So is Amy Klobuchar. But what I'm hearing through back channels is that there is real pressure for Biden to pick someone to heal the party's wounds. So I'm hearing a lot about Elizabeth Warren, and even more so, there is an intense lobbying going on to choose an African-American woman. And as of this moment, unless anything changes, it would seem to me that Biden is leaning towards choosing an African-American woman. And I'll tell you why. One is that African-Americans do not want to be taken for granted, and sloughing over an African-American woman might dampen enthusiasm, especially among African-American women, young women voters. Secondly, that there's a huge difference between blacks being 10 or 11% of the vote, which is the tradition and which is what happened when Hillary ran, or 13% of the vote, which is what happened when Barack Obama ran. And the sense that the most loyal element of the Democratic Party are African Americans, and that they deserve a place on the ticket. All of which is to suggest, as I've been saying right along, Democrats have to heal the progressive, moderate wing of the party, but then they also have to deal with identity politics. Either one or both of those elements unresolved could spell doom to the party. And now, lastly, Tara Reid. This is quite a complex story, because it reveals a lot about Democrats and about my fellow liberals. You know, when Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was vocal and went after her colleague Al Franken, she was a fellow liberal. She was deemed a traitor because she was able to get a liberal colleague removed or resigned from the Senate. But the reality was for her that we need to be singularly focused on the Me Too issue, and there can be no exceptions. Now, what we're finding is, despite some serious allegations by Ms. Reid, the liberal movement is kind of split. And prominent women, this time Gillibrand herself, but the major candidates for VP are lining up behind Biden. There's no evidence, and that's problematic. And both sides on this suggesting that there could be some evidence, or there could be defined no evidence. But whatever it is, this issue seems to dangle in the air. Let's parse it. Let me be blunt here. Tara Reid, perhaps something happened and she deserves to be heard on one hand. On the other hand, she seems to be all out for Bernie Sanders, and those who want Joe Biden's neck in all of this are Bernie Sanders supporters. Not Bernie, but Bernie Sanders supporters. This is the sort of thing that can, again, destroy a candidacy and destroy the chances for the Democrats to win. So it's a very serious issue politically.
It's a very serious issue. And we talked about a few weeks ago that it wasn't going to go away. Remember, AOC is the one who really, by my viewpoint, brought this to the forefront by criticizing the Democratic Party and saying we can't be selective about who we're going to believe. If you're going to follow the movement, believe in the movement of Me Too, and believe and listen to all women, then even when it's the guy who's at the moment best poised to defeat Trump, if something comes out, if someone comes out with allegations that he has engaged in misconduct, and we also know from previous, the last couple of years that there have been, all kinds of, situations and even some videos of Joe Biden being inappropriate. And so, I mean, it necessarily shouldn't be entirely a shock that these allegations have come out. And I mean, regarding evidence, there is some footage from the early 90s of Larry King Live, in which a mother, a distraught mother, called in and said, there's a very famous senator who did. I can't quote exactly what she said, but she went on Larry King Live and talked about her daughter and talked about exactly what Tara Reid is talking about. And around the time period, the early 90s. And so, I mean, there's that. I'm not saying that's the smoking gun, but what's amazing is that it seems to be the mainstream media is ignoring AOC. Maybe not entirely ignoring, but shifting aside that she's making a very strong case that this needs to be heard. And I'm not going to get into any reasons or any speculations as to why that's going on. I don't know. I just know that it's happening. But my key question is, will AOC come out and offer her support for Biden like Bernie did? Or will AOC maintain that this needs to be shined a light on, this needs to be investigated, we can't forget about this, we are not going to stay silent about this? If that's the case, which I think as of right now that is going to be the case, then the other story, which we have been covering for a few weeks now, about the behind-the-scenes conversations, the potential behind-the-scenes conversation about, is Biden going to be replaced at a brokered convention? So right now, who would that person be? If that's true, that come the Democratic National Convention, that Biden is going to be moved out because he just becomes too much of a liability, and that indeed more evidence does surface, who would that be?
Well, I have to tell you that if it comes down to removing or resignation by Joe Biden and a brokered convention, that the Democrats may just as well throw in the towel, because that means that after millions of people have voted and have voted in one direction, that there is an undoing of a vote. That's number one. And number two, it means that the Democrats will have a very difficult time agreeing on what to have for lunch, let alone who to replace. And then you reopen the progressive versus moderate wound, and then you reopen the identity wound. And then should there be a woman, and what color should the woman be? And should it be a progressive woman or a gay man? I am not making light of any of these serious issues. What I'm suggesting, however, is that I've seen over the years, these are the very issues that tear the Democratic Party apart. And at this point, if it's a brokered convention in August and virtual, you're looking at very little time then to unite and focus on a campaign.
I think the Democrats in that scenario, if it plays out, and remember last week I said that we shouldn't be surprised by this. We are living in political bizarro world. There's no question about that. It's been that way since 2016. And I have a very strong sense it's not going to go away. But the Democrats, I believe, have two very strong cards up their sleeves in the event of that scenario. The first one, I think, is not out of is very realistic, let's just say, is Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo here in New York State, and I know we can't judge the rest of the Democratic states by New York State, but, you know, New York State is often seen as the progressive state. But Cuomo, you know, who typically is more favorable downstate, I guess you could say south of Dutchess County, Cuomo has, the last I saw in terms of the numbers, an almost 80% approval rating.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, I mean, that encompasses even a lot of upstate New York. And for anyone who knows New York state politics, there is a great divide between upstate and downstate. But, you know, Cuomo is progressive. He calls himself a progressive, but he has demonstrated the ability to unite a great amount of the state voters, you know, through his, let's say, stepping up onto the scene. At least that's how, you know, the New York state voters are seeing it, post COVID-19 crisis. And then the other person, I would say, and we can go back and forth on whether this is realistic or not, but from a tactical, strategic standpoint, Michelle Obama. There's no question about it that she could unite the moderates and the progressives, and maybe there could even be some kind of ticket. Now, I don't know the deep politics of the DNC, and I don't know the behind-the-scenes conversations at the topmost level, but in terms of who could unite in that, in the midst of that shattering event of Biden being kicked out, those two names seem to be the most realistic.
Well, they certainly seem to be prominent. Remember, though, I in my life, I have seen people who've had approval numbers in the 90s go down to the 30s in a matter of months. And then I've also seen where as soon as you become a presidential nominee, there's all kinds of scrutiny in your personal life, your public life, and all of that gets aired, and then gets aired in a very short period of time. Sort of thing, you don't get that kind of scrutiny as a U.S. senator or as a president. You do, or I'm sorry, as a governor, you do get it, though, when you're potentially a candidate for president. We'd have to see how either of these folks would hold up. But believe me, there would be a rebellion within the Democratic Party. And in either case, not sure that supporters of Bernie would be mollified by either Cuomo or Michelle Obama, not because of who they are, but because of the fact that they're not purists. And I'm not talking about Bernie himself. I'm talking about the so-called Bernie bros. So this could get ugly. For now, though, something somehow is going to have to make this Tara Reid case go away, and it hasn't happened yet.
So I'd like to take a quick break, and then we'll move on to the next segment that we have here, which is very exciting. And for those, and I know there are a lot of you out there who are trying to get a sense for what is the future? What is the future of this country? We are indeed at a crossroads. Well, we have an intelligence report, I'll call it, although we're kicking around some names. And let's take a short break, and we'll get back to that and some of the topics that we want to investigate and research as to what can give us a sense of what the future looks like. Welcome back. Here we are at the second part of our show here, our podcast, The Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. And in this segment, we're going to share with you a report that we, Zogby Strategies, are going to be doing. It's going to be twice a month. And what we are seeking to figure out is, what is the future of America? What is the pulse of America? Here we are at the crossroads, and amidst this great crisis, the COVID-19 crisis. And before this crisis, there were all kind of hot button issues. There was identity politics. there was abortion. It was still a big issue. Gun rights and amidst all of the school shootings and public shootings. And not to say that these hot button issues have gone away completely. It's just that in the middle of a new crisis, they have been pushed to the back front. And now what's at the forefront are other issues, new things that are that America is being faced with at this crossroads. And we at Zogby Strategies are going to research this in our report. And so we want to share with you some of the hot button issues that we think are going to take the forefront and are going to help us define what is the future of America. Before I go over what some of those hot button issues are, I'd like our subscribers and our listeners to email us with some feedback, because we have a few ideas about the names of what this report should be. And so I'm going to just rattle off a few ideas, and we'd really appreciate the feedback. So the first idea is that we would call this The Intelligentsia, A Guide to the Future. The second one would be The Intelligencer Report, also A Guide to the Future. And the last one that we're kicking around is The Compass, A Path to the Future. And so if you could just let us know which one you think, or even just play around with a few of those options, that would be great. So, Dad, I'm now going to move on to a few of these hot button issues out of many that we're going to be testing among a nationwide survey of 1,000 likely voters in the U.S. So the first one I think that we should talk about is the protests that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. The increasing wave of protesters in various state capitals who are very upset over a combination of the business shutdowns and the stay-at-home orders. And so what we want to know from the public is, are these protests legit, or are these protesters or protests, are they a danger to the community and to the country? And so, Dad, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a lot of one and a little bit of both. You have to be able to understand that those who are out of work, when we talk, even in good times, that most people are 1, 2, 3 paychecks away from being totally broke and homeless. This is where we're seeing that come to play. And in just 6 short weeks, we're talking about 33 million people alone who've applied for unemployment benefits. There are many, many more out there. And so these are people, even with their ability in many instances to get an unemployment check, they're facing some disaster and some deep changes in their lives. So the protests, the sentiment behind them is very real. By the same token, the vitriol that's expressed at these protests, point to an organized political campaign from the right, particularly in Democratic states against Democratic governors who have, some of the tightest lockdowns of any of the states. The public, the polls are clear. They show that the overwhelming majority of people support the lockdowns and the non-reopening of non-essential parts of the economy. Where the fault lies, I think, in all of this is the lack of central leadership, the lack of a coherent message. Initially, the president saying, governors, it's all up to you. And then backing off and saying, no, the power is here. It's all up to me. But if you need anything, governors, it's all up to you. And then when governors move on their own, there's severe criticism. I think we not only live in disruptive times with a lack of nationwide leadership, but this is when national leadership matters, and we're not getting it. Bottom line is that the country is horribly split, and we are starting to see disruption turning to violence. So we want to probe more deeply, don't we?
We want to probe more deeply because we're at a point where, so while currently the polls will show a majority that are in favor of the stay-at-home orders and the business shutdowns, we know that as of this month, there is the increasing prospect of meat shortages, specifically mm-hmm. pork and beef, because of plant shutdowns, that there's growing unemployment. Today, a report is going to come out, and it could very well likely show unemployment at or around 25%. How much longer are small and medium-sized businesses going to be able to sustain themselves through this lockdown? So it's important that, although while right now the consensus is in favor, a month or two from now, we don't know. And so that's why we want to know and offer our listeners and our supporters with that kind of data that will point us to where is the future headed.
So just as you were speaking, I got an NBC News alert saying that the unemployment rate officially is at 14.7%. And we know the old rule is generally to double that to get the true unemployment rate. So we're looking at somewhere in the high 20s as the unofficial unemployment rate. But 14.7 as a recorded rate is the worst since the Great Depression.
It is. And the Minnesota Federal Reserve Governor, Neel Kashkari, was on the TV the other day saying that it's definitely higher than what the last report showed, because there are people who simply aren't working or aren't looking for work. The unemployment rate only captures those who have just who are actively seeking. It doesn't capture those who have given up. And with lockdowns and stay-at-home orders and business shutdowns, how can there be people actively looking for jobs?
Let me just add something else. I think our listeners know this already. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to reach the outmoded technology of labor department offices in all 50 states and can't break through, and they're not added into any numbers.
And so the other topic, or one of the other topics that we want to look at that is at the forefront right now, and it will be a very, let's say, a telling issue of where we're headed. There's a lot of talk, you know, one of the phrases that's being kicked around a lot is trust science. Hmm. And it's a very popular phrase. And what we want to know from the American public is, you know, on the one hand, is there a consensus on what is science? And if there is a consensus on what is science, you know, do you put your faith in the experts with the credentials? Or on the flip side, is science really like any other field where there isn't consensus, and that there are independent researchers who may not be, you know, part of think tanks or may not be from your Harvards and your MITs, but still either very legitimate institutions, or they just go against the grain? And how much of the public falls into either one of these categories? Is there a majority? Does a majority go along more with the moniker of trust science, or how much of the public thinks that there is no consensus, that science is something that is a continuous debate, you know, through the use of the scientific method and observation and gathering of new empirical data can upturn what we once thought was the consensus viewpoint? And so that is a raging debate. And I'd like to know how the public fares on that. What do you think?
We've been polling about science versus skepticism towards science for years now. And, you know, the majority do support trust science. However, it's a strong number of folks who are skeptical. So I'm interested in getting back into this debate and finding out the numbers where they stand today, because it's not only essential to understanding how we get through this crisis, it's also, I think, a major wedge issue in this campaign. Democrats will run on science and trusting science, and that will be not only to their base, but a direct appeal, I think, to younger folks who've grown up believing a whole lot more in science than any previous age cohorts. But there is still a strong base of people who, whether they are governed by their spiritual faith or governed by simply just a lack of trust of everyone, who, you know, will just see, you know, the imperfections and the holes in science. I'd like to know what those precise numbers are. And that's the beauty of this project and the fact that through subscriptions, we'll be sharing the Intelligencer report or whatever we ultimately call it twice a month to folks.
And so the next one is also very, very huge and has been for some time. And it really ties into what we just talked about on the science debate and where the public stands. But this one is on social media. Are social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, are they justified in deplatforming those who hold independent views that are not in, let's say, within the consensus view of what is scientific? Do these platforms have a right to do that? Is this a dangerous or slippery slope? Or should they maintain, let's say, a neutral standpoint in allowing for debate? And whether we have your, let's say, consensus oriented people, your mainstream views of whatever the topics are, political, scientific debates, or do you allow for the independent voices as well? And just basically leave it up to the followers, leave it up to the people engaging in these platforms to work it out themselves and engage in debate. And so I'm very curious as to where the public stands on that. I mean, that really gets into the First Amendment. It gets into censorship. And I think this is going to be very revealing of where we're at and where we are headed.
I totally agree. And I'm going to try to answer this in 140 characters rather than expound upon it. Time to expound is later. But you're right. This is deep. What's the role of a media? You know, is it independent? Is it adversarial? Is it a sacred trust? Or is it just people covering the news as they see it? And then what's our role as consumers, you know, to just, you know, put a quarter in a machine, pick up a newspaper and be passive, or to watch television and say, that's awful? We have mechanisms now, and no surprise, we knew we always would, to get news from so many different sources. And the burden really is on the public to be able to sift through a lot of this. But we're at a point where we distrust the media as much, if not more, than we distrust our own political leaders. So we have multiple crises going on at a time when we need the truth. The problem is there are 328 million versions of the truth on every issue. But social media also gives us the opportunity to act on what we see in ways that we've never been able to before. So, you know, it's one thing to be a passive viewer and to share it with family and friends. It's a whole other thing to stir up others and to go viral and to shut down mechanisms. And this is pretty complicated stuff. But you're right, we're going to be getting at what the real sentiment is and where the levels of intensity are regarding social media and its impact.
And so I've got three last issues, and I'm going to fast track these just for the interest of time, because I know you want to talk about a book that you recently finished and that you'd like to fit within 140 characters. so the last three issues, and again, there are much more than this that we're going to probe the public. But one is, and you're hearing this more and more. This has been a debate over the last month. The idea of biometric ID tracking. Is this something that should be mandated, or should there be choice behind it? On the topic of mandated or choice is also the vaccine issue, the coronavirus vaccine, when it does come to the market, or when it does get into the hands of whether it's the CDC or the health department. Is this something that should be mandated, or should there be choice? Incredibly hot button issues. And then the last thing, which I think is also extremely telling of where we're headed, is 5G and AI, the so-called next economy to be powered by 5G and AI. Does the public think that this is a leap forward, or do they think that this is a leap backward for civilization? We are going to have all of these answers, and I think we're all going to be better prepared for what the future holds, because we will know it within a matter of a few weeks. But Dad, please give the last word on the book. Tell us what it is and what it was about and why it's relevant.
I really highly endorse this book. It's huge. It's the Book of Kings, and it's by a friend of mine, James Thackara, Thackara. And it is a massive book about the rise of Nazism in Germany, the war in Europe and into Russia, and about four major characters, young men becoming then middle-aged men during this period in France, and each from a completely different social and political background, and the very, I would say, impossible moral choices that they have to make, not only to survive themselves, but to help save the lives of tens, hundreds, of thousands, even millions of people. It is about moral choices, ethical dilemmas, ultimate choices, and having to live with those choices in the midst of the ugliest catastrophe in the last century. And it's particularly relevant because we're talking today about the worst catastrophe since World War II and the very difficult moral choices that have to be made. You know, a hairdresser in Dallas says, I'm going to lose my business, and the women that work for me have to feed their children and they're on the verge of starving. I'm going to work. She gets jailed, but then released. Versus the governor of Florida and the governor of Georgia, who make moral decisions in their view to open up the economy and face an enormous amount of criticism from scientists. The fact is, in a review that I posted of the Book of Kings on Amazon, we all face these moral dilemmas. And what Thackara did was he wrote about characters. I just didn't read about the lives of these characters. I lived those lives. He has a tremendous talent of putting the reader inside the minds and the hearts of these people as they face this character. It is the Book of Kings that face these dilemmas. The Book of Kings by James Thackera. It is on Amazon. It is a huge book, but it's well worth reading. And that's it for me. I hope I see sales go up.
Well, thank you, everyone, for tuning in again. Don't forget to share, to subscribe if you haven't, and keep listening. We've got a lot more coming, and this has only been 18 weeks. So we'll see you next week. Take care.